Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the Mr. Beacon podcast. This week I'm in Helsinki in Finland, about to attend the Cooper Developer Conference, Partner Conference. It's a really great event, and I'm hoping to get some interesting interviews with the folks at Cooper and some of the people that they've invited to this event. In the meantime, we've opened the archives, the back catalogue, and I'm going to bring you one of my favourite past episodes. It's with Melanie Neuss, who heads up innovation at GS1. Now, the GS1 Connect conference was actually this last week in San Diego. I went along to it, and I was reminded about how much I'd forgotten about all of the things you really should know about GS1. So this episode is for those of us who felt like they knew a bit about GS1 and forgot about it. And if you're in the auto ID space, if you're interested in commerce and identification and supply chains, you really need to listen to this episode. So this is where we get into a lot of the basics that I think most people don't know. I certainly didn't know about what's the difference between a UPC and a GTIN and a serial GTIN and a GLN. And all this stuff is actually kind of important. And Melanie does a great job of making it interesting. We also get to talk to her in our traditional Easter egg piece of the show about her travels around the world, which I found fascinating. I actually watched the whole thing in its entirety just now. Even though I'm short of time and kind of busy, I found it really engaging. So I hope you do too. Thanks for dialing in, and we'll be back in 2 weeks' time with some new episodes, new interviews that I'm going to be recording this week and next.
The Mr. Beacon podcast is sponsored by Williot, intelligence for everyday things, powered by IoT Pixels.
Welcome to another episode of the Mr. Beacon podcast. We really appreciate you joining us on this journey where we discover all the things that solutions architects need to know when they're building the next generation of auto ID solutions, beacons and tags and all of the technology and protocols are what we deal with. This week, I'm very excited to have an important chapter in what we study. We're going to be talking about GS1, and I have Melanie Neuss from GS1. She's part of the senior leadership team there, and we're going to be talking about GS1. I think it's really key that people understand the organization, some of the standards, and then what's happening in this next generation of supply chain technology and systems that are rolling out. So, Melanie, thanks so much for joining us.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for having me on the show.
And I think, GS1 is one of these terms that most people have heard about. A lot of people don't really understand super well. It's really a very significant organization. Can you introduce us to GS1 and what should someone who's entering this industry and wanting to to build solutions, what should they know about the organization itself?
Sure. GS1 is a global standards organization. We're most well known for our standards and supply chain identification, starting with what we now refer to as the humble barcode, whether that's a UPC or an EAN, depending on what part of the world you're in, which was first scanned in the 1970s. Approaching 50 years of this very simple but powerful linear barcode technology. And that was how we became an organization, was a coalition of industry members in the consumer goods space that wanted to facilitate better checkout experience and more accuracy in price for consumers. And we started there in the 70s, and now, all over the world, GS1 barcodes are scanned 6 billion times a day. But to your point, Steve, around being sort of the littlest known and really the backbone, essentially, of retail commerce, right? This notion of the barcode that goes beep. What we've done over the past four decades is expand the notion of standards, not only around core product identification, but all of the notions of that product within a supply chain, cases and pallets and assets, a data model that surrounds supply chain information and how partners can exchange meaningful data to drive business decisions. And of course, most recently, how do we take advantage of emerging technology and what role do we play while we continue to maintain that not-for-profit neutral reputation that we're most appreciated for in bringing industry collaborators together. But I work at GS1 US. We are one of 115 member organizations of GS1 all over the world. So it's a federation. The global standard is how we all feed into ensuring consistency. But we do local implementation, time zone, and language support in each of our different countries. And about 2 million businesses all over the world use GS1 standards. And so I've had the great fortune in the past couple of years as self-checkout has become more prevalent. When you sit on an airplane and somebody says, oh, what do you do? Which my husband used to say she works in accounting. And I don't know why that is, but counting products, but not accounting. So you get the chance to say to someone, have you tried self-checkout? Oh, I've done that. And I said, well, the little barcode that goes beep when you pass that over the scanner, there's actually a standard for managing that those numbers are unique and that the bag of potato chips rings up at its correct price and, the four pack of toilet paper rings up at its correct price. So it's very interesting when you get to talk about the foundation that GS1 standards provide, but the criticality of the technology that then enables those standards for all the members around the world.
So how many people work at the organization? It's bigger than I think most people would have initially thought when they think about, AIM or the groups that curate RFID or Bluetooth is a big organization. But my sense is that you have a lot more people. How many?
Well, in the U.S., we have 175 employees, but I would say there are some GS1 member organizations that have two. I think one of the ones in Central America that I had looked up has seven. So we range from, right, and GS1 U.S. is the biggest, I think, geographically, right, we represent significant amount of commerce. And so we're probably the largest member organization, but others like Germany, Australia, United Kingdom, France, of course, in Asia, and the work that they're doing around sensors and IoT between Hong Kong, Japan, China. And then we sort of augment how big we are with partnerships with other organizations like the Auto ID Labs. There are seven of those all over the world. And in the US, my team manages the relationship with MIT. And so we kind of use them as an extension of staff to help us accelerate investigation into tech and standards.
And how you're a nonprofit, but you get revenue somehow. What's the mechanism?
Our primary revenue model is licensing identifiers. So every part of a global trade item number, or what most people understand as a UPC, is a company prefix. And that company prefix system is managed by the member organization. So GS1 Global confers essentially a bank of numbers to each member organization, and then we license those out to our members in varying capacities, right? For a large company, may hold many, many prefixes. If you're manufacturing apparel, you're turning over a lot of products. You probably have in the tens or maybe even the hundreds of different prefixes that you pull from. And then again, you might be a really small business that I know someone who happened to launch custom coffee sleeves, the little, you know, warming sleeves in kind of an environmentally friendly way. And she had, I think, 4 or 5 designs. And so she has a very small allocation of GS1 identifiers. But our primary revenue comes from licensing those identifiers out to our members.
So if I'm a brand, I might have a few hundred. So what is it? Is it a prefix for each category, or it's not a prefix for each product?
No. So a prefix has varying capacity. If you in the US, the largest capacity we license is 100,000. So when you license that number from us, you can create up to 100,000 unique trade items. And that would, you know, in apparel, it would be sort of like this level, style, color, size, footwear, one particular size of a shoe in a particular color is one G10. So you can imagine in footwear, you need lots of numbers. But by the same token, in beverages, you would need a different one for each flavor and a different one for each size. Because again, when you scan that barcode at the point of sale, that drives the price lookup. And so you have to have those different price points and different identifiers to support that. But yeah, so we go all the way down to the single. Actually, in November of last year was the first time we released the ability for a business to just come and license one trade item number from us. Now, the flip side of that is that we're not only just about product identifiers. The GS1 system supports location, asset, entity identifiers, documents, and service relationships. And so a GS1 prefix is actually the key that unlocks your ability to create a whole suite of unique identifiers for different supply chain contexts. And so a lot of what we do in the US is help educate our members about the power of that unlock. It's not just about being able to assign that to your, you know, your box of rice, but also to every distribution center. And you can even put embedding in advanced data carriers, asset identifiers on trailers and, you know, tests for cold chain purposes or other things. So there are 12 different GS1 keys, and we're the stewards over that numbering system and then helping members implement them in different ways to achieve business benefit.
So what would an example of a GS1 key mean? That's a type of code, is it?
Yeah, so the global trade item number is one of the keys. That's the most common one that gets put into a UPC barcode. We have one called a global location number. That one, these all, of course, are acronym-based, and so that we call a GLA, a GLN. Those identify either entities or locations most commonly used in supply chain transactions, right? So if you and I are going to exchange data electronically, we need to know who each other is. And so you have kind of that entity identifier that says, I'm company A and you're company B, or you may have location identifiers that say, this product came from this warehouse in Malaysia or this distribution center in New Jersey, but also at an asset level, where we've seen a lot of interesting implementation is in things like rail. And, you know, this is in Europe primarily, where they've used the global individual asset identifier to put sensors at different points along a railway in order to track maintenance and performance. And so those GS1 keys are essentially what ways can I use my GS1 prefix to construct unique identifiers that I can then apply in a supply chain context for different use cases, right? So tracking product, creating relationships, exchanging electronic information. There's a whole variety of different ways you can bring them together.
So why do I need to, as a maker of railroad infrastructure, or a brand, why do I need to get these numbers? I guess it's essentially what we're talking about from GS1. Why don't I just make it up myself?
Make it up.
And, yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting because if the world was just about one company and you were in charge of everything, you probably wouldn't need a GS1 identifier. But this was the real key, right? Even back in the 70s, when they were first talking about putting a barcode on a package, was to say, I have to know the difference between scanning a product from Coca-Cola and a product from Pepsi. And Coke and Pepsi were distributing their products into every grocery store, every mass merch, every convenience store. And you needed a common identifier in order to drive, first of all, global uniqueness, so that you don't have a clash of numbers. Because if you and I both create proprietary numbers, there's a risk that we'll create the same number. You had also, I think, that the notion of governance over those numbers to ensure that there wasn't going to be duplication at an issuance level. Every country has a responsibility, right, to make sure that we're following the principles of the system. And I think then the other piece is, because we are a complex ecosystem of companies, when we want to abstract data out of our four walls and pass it along to another trading partner, we call GS1 the global language of business, right? It's about making that common way to abstract data. It's been really fascinating as you've seen technology like blockchain come onto the scene, and everybody's like, blockchain's going to solve all the problems and it'll create these traceable supply chains. Well, sure, but you have to have data. A blockchain is just a mechanism to exchange and store data. But if you don't have a business agreement on what that payload looks like, and so those unique identifiers sort of became the anchor for additional information, whether that be attributes or transaction data, that when you and I exchange that, we know that we're speaking in a common way. So that was really where the genesis of standards came from. And certainly, I think as we've moved from a purely physical world where going beep at the checkout makes so much sense, that I need to have a unique identifier that's well understood by all the parties. As we move into a digital environment, I would say that the additional value of those global identifiers is all around analytics, because now we're seeing just this proliferation of distributed data, and I need to be able to get all that together, assemble it, and make some decisions about it. And the best way is right through linking that, linking a common identifier to all of that data.
It makes me think about IP addresses on the internet. The internet wouldn't work unless everyone on it had a unique address. And it seems like GS1 serves a similar functions for identifying products. You have this uniqueness, this ability to interact and exchange information. How much does it cost? If I go into business, I'm going to start making Steve Statler perfume, I want a GS1 code. What am I paying for that?
$30. If you just want to make one bottle, one type, one size, one scent, $30. So it ranges in price. The GS1 US and each country, right? We're independent, so I can't speak to what other countries may offer in terms of pricing. But in the US, our pricing is public. It's available on our website. But it ranges from that, again, that lowest one of a single item. I'm just going to create one thing. I met a woman many years ago. It's the strangest thing that probably doesn't even, people don't use it anymore because we're all at home for one, so we don't wear earrings. But she made this tool that adjusted the tightness of your clip-on earring. And at the time when I was working with her, I was very young in my career, and I was like, people wear clip-on earrings? I guess my grandma did. But as you get older, you understand like earrings are painful and there's some value in that. But she made a tool that was just this one thing she made. So it was just one GTIN. She didn't need a bunch. And so today, and these capabilities back then didn't exist. But today we have the ability to offer that single at $30. Our largest capacity, as I mentioned before, in the US that we license is 100,000. Those, I believe, go for $10,500. And so when you start looking at your per item price, there's right, it scales down as you license more capacity. But $30 for a single. And if you're curious, you can always just go out to the website and acquire a single. Then you'll have a GTIN. Someone was telling me yesterday, we were on a call with a customer, and they said, don't underestimate the idea of a vanity claim by a small brand, because a small brand would say, well, to your point, like, why do I need a unique identifier? I'm just a small brand. I'm selling out of my garage. I'm listed on one marketplace. And, you know, I'm managing my own supply chain. Like, I'm using local small parcel provider to send products to customers. I don't need this. But to be able to say, right, I'm affiliated with a global standards organization. I have a unique identifier. If I ever get that promising deal with Kroger or Sephora or PetSmart, you know, they're going to need, it's going to need a barcode in physical retail. It was just interesting because I had never thought about, we always think of, you know, what is the value proposition around unique ID? It's our job to make sure people understand that for the value of supply chain efficiency. But when she said, don't underestimate that small brands might be interested in this vanity ID, I'm like, all right, perfect. We'll add that to our list of, you know, reasons to license. But A lot of different reasons, I guess.
Yeah, we just joined Wiliot, and so we got our first identifiers. And part of the reason we joined was we wanted to, because we have these battery-free Bluetooth tags that are going to be used for conveying this sort of information, we felt like, well, we need to kind of eat our own dog food. We need to use these yes. standards so that we can organize our own products. And that's actually, it's been great. And also, I have to say, we just feel a little bit more grown up. We've moved from that early stage of prototypes and that sort of thing. Oh, we're shipping in volume. We have our own GS1 codes. And so it's felt good for us.
I love it.
So why have different GS1 organizations in different countries? It's kind of one standard, presumably. So
the interesting thing is business still happens very much locally, right? The notion of walking into your market in your village, your hometown, and your local language being on the packaging and the people who produce that. I think e-commerce is certainly driving more of the idea of a global marketplace, but satisfying the quantitative needs inventory wise of a global consumer community is probably daunting for anybody. Some years ago, I can recall that when we're talking about part of the GS1 standard is what we call the Global Data Synchronization Network. And it's essentially a network of data pools that have information about items in trade. And before we started this idea of data pools that would interoperate, and I think there's probably 30 some odd, that I might be wrong, there might be 40 all over the world that said, I know about these products and you know about these products. And, you know, we'll create an orchestration to allow people to exchange information globally about them. We had one really large retailer say, look, I just need to keep frozen peas on the shelf and I need to know where can I find frozen peas. So there are those players who need that sort of global view of where are peas available. But producers tend to still be very local. When you think about coffee bean farmers in South America or people who grow strawberries or lettuce here in the United States or leafy greens, which have, you know, been very interesting in a supply chain context in the past decade, that's still happening very much at a local level. And so it would be probably very difficult as a single organization for us to service all of those language, time zone, and implementation needs. And frankly, priorities are a little bit different. If you're in a very advanced country that's looking at things, like IoT-based sensors, whether they be Bluetooth or NB-IoT or UHF or NFC, your smorgasbord of acronyms, which we're all dealing with, certainly in the leading company space. In some other countries, it's really more of the question of, look, I grow strawberries and information about these strawberries is important as they move down the chain, but I don't have the margin or the technology to invest in making sure, right, that all of that rich automated data is available. And very simply, someone can provide me a little bit of local support and likely a sensor that I can drop into the each tray of strawberries as it loads onto the truck, and somebody else is actually going to then reap the benefit of that data. But even to get to that farmer and explain to them the value of that sensor requires boots on the ground, right? Somebody who's got cultural knowledge, language knowledge, and the time within their business day to support them.
So if you were to enumerate the handful of key functions that GS1 fulfills, what would those be? Part of it is obviously this making sure that the codes that people use are unique. There's some standards. There's a lot of standards that exist and presumably new ones that are being built out. You work in this innovation space. What are the other areas that where you're helping the industry?
Well, I think the coalition of the willing is a big part of what my team does in innovation. How do you get a retailer, a manufacturer, maybe a distributor, oftentimes transport providers, especially now as we're looking at the criticality of some supply chains, whether it's food or pharmaceuticals, cold chain is a very interesting space really now, right? And making sure that you maintain the integrity of that. And GS1 has always been known as a convener. So our core standards, identify, capture, and share, right? Give something a unique identifier, capture information about it in a machine readable way, share that with trading partners in order to drive business decisions. That's the foundation of the standard. Well, then, of course, the practicality is in how do I implement that? And so those are a little bit of where we talk about, right, implementation services across the world, how we connect communities with an education about the standard, driving awareness, because to your point, GS1 may be a company you've heard of, or it may not be. When you talk about a UPC barcode, for example, in the US, most people get that. Oh, it's that thing with the bars and spaces, you know, on the back of a package. But they don't, most of them will say, oh, I didn't know there was someone overlooking that system. And so educating people as they're entering the commerce landscape, new business owners, you know, the majority of our new members in the US are very tiny companies, commensurate with what's happening in the e-marketplace space, right? As lots and anybody can launch a business now. I think the pandemic also really highlighted the ability of anybody who has an idea, now's your time. You're all stuck at home. Some great ideas were coming out of that. And so helping people understand how to implement the standard, but I also think one of the most important things that we are passionate about in the US is getting the technology community to embed standards in what they're taking to market. Because as I had said it before, standards are only as good as the technology that enables them. So if we aren't helping technology providers create that baseline, then there isn't that scale. And so, you know, I like to talk about the multiplier and how we're a small, even at 175 people, GS1 US is a small organization. But if I can get the partnership of, you know, Williot and other partners that you guys work with to be talking to all of your customers and prospects about how standards can enable what they're trying to do with their supply chain, that's just an incredible benefit of having that community. So we're very committed to that technology provider community in the US, and how you guys are exponentiating what standards can do for the end user.
Cool. That's a great explanation.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
I'd like people who listen to us to be able to go away and feel like they're a bit smarter than they were before. And I think you've laid out a lot of new information, at least from my perspective. But help us really nail what is a UPC and what is a GTIN. I mean, these are acronyms that are used extensively. Yeah.
No, that's such a good point. A barcode, a UPC is a type of barcode. So oftentimes it gets mistaken that a UPC is a number. A UPC is actually a symbology, and it's the symbology that appears on bags of lettuce and jars of salad dressing, you know, as I mentioned before, bottles and cans of soda. That is a UPC. There are other types of barcodes. So you could just say, right, a UPC is a type of barcode, and there are many different barcode technologies. And as you know, other sensor and advanced data carriers, but a technology like a barcode or an RFID tag has to have something embedded in it, a unique identifier that says, when I read this, I know what you are. Now I can actually start to tie data to you in a meaningful way. That global trade item number, what we call the GTIN, is the number that then gets translated into that barcode symbol. Or that's the number that gets embedded into a UHF RFID chip so that when a fixed infrastructure reader, right, is reading a floor of inventory inside of a department store, it can actually tell the difference between all of the things that are sitting on the sales floor. So the numbering system is essentially part of, when we talk about identification and GS1 keys, those are all numbering conventions. They follow specific size. They usually have a check digit so that you can confirm it's been calculated correctly, that it is a valid number. And then when we move into capture, we say, how do you take those numbers and embed them into something a machine can read? Because that's where the benefit of automation comes from. And those are barcodes. And what a lot of people don't realize is that not all barcodes are the same, right? There are very simple barcode like a UPC that's used to drive a checkout experience, and very complex barcodes. Even in the linear barcode space, like we have a serialized identifier that you put in a barcode called a GS1128, which is all about moving cartons through distribution centers. And right, so I'm sure many of your listeners are too young to know this, but I know. Back in the day, all receiving that happened in a supply chain was manual, and right, you were opening boxes and looking or pulling packing slips off cartons. And when we went to barcode technology within distribution centers, they created this notion of cross-docking, where I could read a carton, it had a barcode that tied to an electronic record that said, this has 15 t-shirts in it, and they're destined for store 100, right? And you didn't even open that box, your conveyor system sent it off to the truck that was waiting for store 100. It's, as a regular consumer, you just don't real. I love how one of our board members, he always says, you know, the challenges we have around data and managing data and exchanging data within supply chains are quite cumbersome. They're definitely challenging for us, but the miracle of trade still happens. And the miracle of trade is because over time we've invested in these technologies that have allowed us to really accelerate how things move through a supply chain. And all of that is different types of barcode and RF technology where the unique numbers get embedded.
So this may be confirmation bias, but where I see a significant change that's happening, it's been happening for a while, but it really seems to be accelerating, is this move from to serialization, to giving more and more things, not just a general description, a SKU or whatever, but giving them each individual item this ID, because that's enabling authenticity, traceability, recall management, better linking of the owner with the product, and so many reasons why people are doing it. How, help us understand where this unique serialized identifier fits with SKUs and GTINs. Can you map out their interrelationship?
Yes. And I'll try to do, you know, I know you have an astute audience, so this will probably not be a big leap for them. But the GTIN, the global trade item number, what you see in a UPC barcode, is just a class level identifier. So every bag of 9-ounce regular flavored potato chips from brand X all have the same one, right? So to your point, if you want to get value from expiry management or recall support, inventory rotation, it has to be a little bit more robust. And our biggest frustration, like me as an innovator, maybe it's not even very innovative to be honest, is there are these little printed codes on every package that you see, right? If you pick up a beverage, you'll see there's this little printed code, and it's the batch lot identifier, which gets added at the time the product goes into the package, because the package has been manufactured somewhere else. It's brought to the plant, and then the product goes inside of it. And this is really why we haven't gotten to a great level of serialization in sort of fast-moving consumer goods. But it is 100% needed in order to automate some of these terribly manual processes that actually not only continue to perpetuate like labor inefficiency within, you know, a retail environment, but actually have major impact on the consumer. You know, the example of where you go in to buy a product and the product itself is not recalled, but there has been a recall on something, a different batch of that same product. The problem is because those codes aren't machine readable, that store is either making a decision to not sell you that product because some recall flag came up when you tried to scan it at the point of sale, but they don't have a way right through the barcode or the sensor to tell, or they're pulling wholesale product off shelves, or in fact, they're selling you something they shouldn't sell because right nobody went and did the homework to pull the recalled batches off the shelf. So this move towards serialization is 100% required. And what we would even say is if you just sort of skip batch lot, because that's a thing in low margin consumer goods, we all get batch lot. Serialization seems so scary to us. But the truth is, if I just serialized every package when I printed it, then I could add the batch lot data as a cloud reference when I put the product inside the package, right? Serial number one got batch one, serial number two got batch two. Then this, you're bringing now what's on the package with what's in the cloud together to drive that efficiency and experience. And so this is the strongest message that my team is working on right now is how do you get from, you know, a UPC, what we would call a class level identifier. Yes, I know this is a bag of 9 ounce potato chips too. I know it's this 9 ounce bag of potato chips that maybe you know Melanie bought it, maybe you didn't know Melanie bought it, but certainly if you recalled it, you would be able to say, probably through my loyalty card, hey, customer X, we think you bought a recalled product. You should probably return it to the store. Those sort of experiences are right around the corner. If we can move to serializing and then putting that serial number in a machine readable, likely a 2D barcode as one mechanism. I think sensors as a more advanced mechanism, but some combination of a human readable element and right then a very strong high speed machine readable element. This is what we're trying to push industry towards. But in all fairness, Steve, it took us a lot of years to get the UPC on product. And so we've kind of set some target goals for industry around 2027 to move from these 1D barcodes to a more advanced data carrier and start to take advantage of the use cases that are available that we're just not exploiting today because right, we've made a particular technology choice that now needs to be swapped out.
Fascinating. Can you just tell us a bit about what your role is at GS1?
Yes. I am the Senior Vice President of Corporate Development. It's our fancy term for innovation. I lead a team that looks at the intersection of emerging technology and standards to solve current and future business problems. You know, we're a member-driven organization. GS1 is not-for-profit neutral. We have always sat in that collaborative space of solving industry problems that will allow scale, adoption at scale. And so a few years ago, the company decided that we needed to continue to focus on looking around the corner. And so my team was formed and we look at all kinds of interesting topics and I think some that we'll get to explore today.
This sounds like a super interesting role. I can imagine you get to think about challenging problems and work with people that are on the cutting edge. How did you get the job?
I got lucky. You know, it's funny you ask because at the time I was working on the industry side of the business. I was leading the apparel and general merchandise industry engagement community, which is working with all those members in that sector, really around kind of just common supply chain challenges. But apparel was one of the first communities to go down the RFID path with item level RFID and really trying to fulfill that omni-channel promise. So I think I had a little bit of the bug for sort of being on the edge of where we're going with standards. And when we several years ago, we got in a room, we called this Project George, and it was to define an innovation process. I don't know why we picked the name George. We were trying to be very agnostic to the name, right? Just pick a name that means nothing. So we picked the name George, and we sat in a room for a couple of months and formulated what does innovation look like in the realm of standards, right? Because standards are kind of the opposite of innovation to most people. We're waiting for industry to reach these adoption plateaus where they hit a wall and say, hey, we need a standard to kind of level the playing field so we can move forward. And for the first time ever, we were saying, we're actually going to take a leading position. We're going to have a point of view on things, and we're going to start researching emerging technology. So I helped with the team that formulated it at the time, still doing my day job. And a few months later, after our senior leadership team had gone to the board, they came and asked me to run the function. So I've been doing that now 4.5 years. I love it so much. I never knew that I wanted to be an innovator, but I was just remarking to my boss the other day that I feel so fortunate that we invested in an innovation practice. Really, at the same time, a lot of our other corporate partners, right, in the consumer products and healthcare space were doing the same thing. And to that point of technology innovation, not just product R&D, but really how do technologies enable supply chain businesses to progress, in addition to putting good products on the shelf for consumers.
We work in an industry which, in my opinion, has just got terrible, terrible problems with diversity. I work in a company. We're all super well-intentioned. And I'm really conscious that for women in this business, however you define this business, our company's semiconductors and cloud services and auto ID, there's not a lot of women at senior positions like you are. Was it a battle for you because of that, or did you have to be super conscious of your gender in getting to where you've got to? What's it been like for you?
It's actually I adopted this philosophy early on in my career that merit wins. And if you do a good job and you show that you have an aptitude for learning, intellectual curiosity is the thing I tell my team. If you want to be in the GS1 US corporate development team, you better be curious, because you're probably going to be lying on the floor with a cold washcloth pressed to your head many nights of the week, just absorbing all these concepts that we're learning. But actually, I have to say, when I joined and I started this role, I was not part of the senior leadership team. And then about a year into it, our CEO added me to the senior leadership team, where he already had essentially a 50-50 split between men and women. And so I have been the recipient of just some way that had been paved before me. And I actually kind of got accused of having the opposite problem. My team was all women until I got to, our team is now about almost 13 people, but we were all the way up to 6 before we added a man. And now we're almost half and half women and men. We did find that having, and also I have to tell you, Steve, the other important diverse element that we've added, because we have good cultural diversity among the team as well, but also it was generational diversity. When you're working in an innovation role, if you don't bring on some early career professionals, you inevitably will infuse so much confirmation bias into what you're doing. And you can tell yourself that you're willing to change, but it really comes down to having someone on the outside right, challenge you and say, no, this isn't the way the current consumer thinks, or this isn't how my generation views sustainability or circular economy. So it's been really great to have some of those younger voices. And we were all joking, a bunch of the more senior folks on our team were joking that this is who we were 20 years ago when people were shepherding us and really helping us formulate our career trajectory. This is who we are now and training up the next generation. So that's been another exciting angle of diversity that we've employed in our team.
Yeah, that's such a win when you get that. I think it just makes a much better environment. When our company was formed, it was formed by a bunch of really experienced veterans. And I think part of the capital raising was made easier by that. But there's a downside to that. And so we made a conscious effort to get younger people in the organization. Speaking as someone who's not younger.
I feel you.
And it is just really, I think everyone wins. The older people enjoy like passing on some of the experience they've had, but then they're like, you feel younger when you're around younger people and they kind of challenge you and you're like, oh my God, I really need to work hard to keep up with these people that don't need to sleep and have all this energy.
No doubt. Oh, the sleeping.
So I want to get in our standard warm-up questions here and ask you a bit about music. So is music a big part of your life, or is it just kind of the wallpaper in the background?
I love music. I actually studied piano for many years and was able to employ that in a church context as an accompanist for quite some time. But also, I have a boxer who, of course, I've had her since she was 8 weeks old. She's now 11 and a half, and she used to love to dance with me. And so that was when she was young, she'd come up on the two back paws, and we would just, you know, play some music with a great dance beat. And so I, music has been very much, I don't like silence. And so I do really enjoy to have something musical. Of course, now, you know, with the proliferation of podcasts in the world, sometimes you have to balance how much time you get to let yourself go with some music. But anytime I'm working out, anytime I'm doing household chores, there's definitely the shuffle in the background of a variety of genres.
That is funny you mentioned that. I am feeling that conflict. There's just so many good podcasts, and but I like to listen to music, and so your ear time is being stretched between these two things. So when you do listen to music, and if you had to come up with this list of three songs on this trip to Mars, which as of this last week seems like it's more and more probable, and we just saw amazing high definition footage from this spacecraft landing, which is so inspiring. What would you be listening to? What would be the three songs you would take to Mars if, for some reason, you could only have three songs?
Sure. Well, and it would be hard to go without my dog, I suppose, because she was the genesis of sort of the passion for dance. But definitely there's a song called When Love Takes Over. It's by David Guetta, and Kelly Rowland does the singing on it. That's my dog. Her name is Pretzel. That's our jam. And so we always love to dance to that. We'd get her barking and everything. But I also love Can't Stop the Feeling by Justin Timberlake. Again, how can you not get excited and just start moving when you hear that? And I would say last but not least is Levitate by Hadouken, because my nephew is just an amazing aerialist, gymnast, great breakdancing skills. He's 14 now. But I lived with my brother and sister-in-law for many years when he was little, and just got to be there as he learned all these skills. And that was our song. And he would go out in the green belt and do backflips, and we would play that song. So that's what I'm taking to Mars.
I love it. What about, I mean, you seem to travel, maybe not to Mars, but it seems like you travel a lot around the world in your time. You go to other countries and help out. Do you hear different things when you go on those travels? Is that part of the landscape that changes?
Most definitely. People's traditional roots in music have been very interesting as someone who's had the benefit of going to places and hearing and, Latin America. And I just love Latin American influences. There was a year where I actually had spent some time traveling to Spanish speaking countries. And so I put my radio on Spanish pop music, not so much kind of the traditional, Latin music, but their top 40. And so I have quite a few of those songs that are still part of my library. And the other one was I was in Germany some years ago, and this song came on, and it's called Help Me in English. The English translation is Help Me. And it's this man who's brokenhearted over the woman leaving him. And I wanted the song so badly. And the only place that you could buy it at the time was to get on Amazon's German music platform. This, talk about interoperability. We should probably chat about that today. But there was such a lack of it that I had to have a German colleague download the file, get me over the file so that I could have, just had to have the song. But, interestingly, I think the theme of music is very similar all over the world, but just the execution. And maybe that's why I like sort of the upbeat dance, because anywhere you go, you can always generate a spirit of happiness and joy with kind of a dance beat.
And I mean, some of the situations that you deal with, kids who are orphaned, that's pretty sad, but it sounds like music is kind of a balance to these tragic situations.
Most definitely. And I think where you have a language barrier, music can be just a great way to kind of alleviate the stress of not being able to exchange words. I'm very fortunate in that I know how to speak Spanish, but my husband was just commenting to me that our last trip to Mexico, we went down to build a house over Christmas. He was struggling because people assume if one of you speaks Spanish, you both do. And so I'd have these great conversations with the kids that we were partnering with there, and they would just be looking at both of us, and he's kind of nodding his head like, I have no idea what you're saying. So right, but always playing a good tune and getting a lot of diversity in the music. And a lot of other countries really enjoy what I think American music brings to the table as well.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in England, and so I kind of got to see America from afar. Even though I was born in America, I kind of appreciated it from the outside perspective. And our culture is probably one of our strongest diplomatic tools, the movies, the TV, the music, the clothes. So where in the world have you been on these philanthropic journeys that you take?
Primarily, Honduras, Peru, Mexico. I have a real passion for Latin culture. It was something I was very latent inside of me even when I was about 11 years old when I started to study Spanish. I've traveled a lot for work to many places. But also, my husband and I did a trip to the Philippines in 2018. That was a phenomenal trip. And when you talk about, you know, just the economic challenges that you see in another country, and Metro Manila being as large as it is, has just a real poverty, a community that's right experiencing homelessness and poverty. And they kind of shipped all those people away from Manila about 2.5 hours to these little, for lack of a better word, you could call it a relocation camp. And I mean, it's a neighborhood, it's a community. But the joy, people who don't have what we have in America still have this probably even more joy in some cases because they're not distracted by all the things that we are. But just so much fun. And we had the chance while we were there to, somebody had a basketball hoop and happened to have some angle iron and happened to have a welder. The whole community comes together. And my husband was able to help put this basketball hoop at this little property where we were working and play basketball with the kids. And so Philippines is probably the furthest I've gone on a mission trip, but South America and Central America is probably where my heart thinks stays there every time I come back home.
Wonderful. Well, what an adventure. It's been great talking to you about it. Thanks so much.
Yes, thank you.
So that was my interview with Melanie. I think she does a great job of bringing a fascinating insight to life, not only on acronyms, but the organization behind them. And it's easy to forget that there's actually people that are trying to figure this stuff out and promote it and develop the new standards. And I really like this episode because you get to see a very interesting person behind some of the standards that are essential to what we do. So thanks for joining us, and I look forward to our next episode, and hopefully you'll join us for that.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When your skin feels nourished and glows, you radiate confidence. Osea makes giving your skin a glow up easy with their clean, clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This seaweed-powered duo features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OSEAMalibu.com, code GLOW.